I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. The 2016 Olympic Games begin on Friday with the opening ceremony in Rio de Janeiro. Much of the focus has been on the fetid waters, the problem of doping in athletes, and the housing for the athletes. But what about the impact of the Olympics on the residents of Rio, thousands of whom have been displaced? Protesters have taken to the streets this week under the banner, the Exclusion Games. Well, we wanted to know more, and we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Sitting across from me is Maureen Donaghy, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Rutgers University at Camden, and she has been studying the impact of some of this dislocation on residents in Rio and also in other parts of the world as well. And Maureen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us from Rio is Teresa Williamson. She's a city planner, executive director of Catalytic Communities, and that's a Rio de Janeiro-based nonprofit that supports the favela communities. She's also editor of Rio on Watch, and that's a watchdog news site reporting on favela perspectives in the lead up to the Olympic Games. And Teresa Williamson joining us by Skype. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And since you're there in Rio, Teresa, what is the view, what is the perspective of Rio residents, especially those living in the favelas, on the Games as they're about to open?
Yeah, I think there's kind of accumulated frustration from these past few years. And a lot of people, as you mentioned, you know, 80,000 people have been displaced through evictions for the Olympics, and that's not counting the displacements due to people not being able to afford living in the core city, which has experienced huge increases in price in the last few years, though now with the economic stagnation, that's starting to slow down a bit. But yeah, we have protests going on every day this week, a huge lineup from Monday through Friday, culminating with Friday afternoon when there will be a protest near the Olympic Stadium where the opening ceremony is going to take place.
Does that mean people are going to boycott the Olympics or perhaps not watch it? I don't know. Is it carried on TV down there in Brazil?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think most people still will watch some of it. And people, if having the chance, will attend. I think people feel very different about the Olympics sport itself, the games themselves, than the infrastructure and the companies and the corporate kind of interests behind the games. So I think people are able to kind of separate the two and still watch the games and enjoy that aspect of it, even if they're frustrated and angry and deeply affected by what the games have brought.
Teresa, one more question before we get Maureen in on the conversation. What has been the cost so far for Brazil to host the Olympics?
I think most estimates put it at $15 to $20 billion. We'll see where it's going to end up. You know, we're going to be paying for this for a long time. With the economics decline here, that's only furthered the difficulties we're going to experience going forward. So it should be even greater than that.
Does that mean that there will be, program cuts or service cuts in Brazil as a result of the Olympics?
It's possible. I mean, we're already seeing teachers have been striking. The police have been striking. They haven't been paid. Students have been occupying schools where strikes have been taking place, demanding improved conditions for both their studies and for their teachers. And going forward, we expect more of that. I think it's going to be more severe after the game, especially with the international spotlight removed from the city. It's going to make it even harder. And of course, the costs that are going to hit us. I think, very deeply after the games.
Maureen, are you surprised at the response of Rio residents to the Olympics coming to their city?
Not really. I mean, I think from the beginning they felt very positively. But I would say, you know, they are probably disappointed in what has occurred since since the Olympics were announced to be there. But probably not surprised. Right. So they, you know, hoped that the government would come through on the promises to increase the social equality in the city through infrastructural development. But you know, given the past history of inequality in the city, I don't think anyone's really surprised that some of the projects that didn't get completed, you know, have to do with sanitation infrastructure and, you know, bus lines that would have actually reached some of the poorer communities. So, you know, I think as they go forward, people are just going to kind of like move on. You know, they're more concerned about the fiscal crisis and the what the government of Rio is going to do about that in the future.
You have looked at a particular community in Rio. What is this community and why does it interest you?
So the community that I studied was Vila Autódromo, which Teresa has also been very involved with. And they it was a community of about 600 families next door to the main Olympic site. It was always next to an autodrome, a racetrack, which is where it gets its name. But it was a community that started as fishermen, and they received a notice of eviction in about 2009, and they started fighting back. They used the legal system. They used the civil public defenders to help them, and along the way, they realized that that wasn't going to be enough. So they really reached out to people like Teresa and other NGOs and university faculty and students to really help them to approach the international press. And that has been their strategy. They have really broadened their struggle beyond, you know, just the community. And they act as a symbol, you know, for people who are being displaced by the Olympics, and they've really used that to their advantage,
and been successful.
So what happened was, you know, it's hard to say whether they've been successful. So they, of the families that originally existed, only about 20 remain. And so what happened was, along the way, the government made promises that they would allow them to remain. But then they sort of backtracked on that. They started offering people units in public housing that was close by, so that was a little bit of a victory. They started offering people more market rate indemnity payments for their properties. And many people chose to leave eventually. But there was a core group that stayed, and in the end, they did receive the right to have houses built for them by the government on the site. And so they are still there, about 20 families. They just received the keys to their new homes, and so they remain there.
Teresa, let me go back to you and your group or your organization, Rio on Watch. This is a watchdog news site reporting on the favelas and reading a number of the articles, part of Rio on Watch. It's clear that I think people outside of Brazil, perhaps Westerners, people looking at that country from afar, don't understand the favelas, see them in one way, perhaps, you know, places ridden with crime. But reading about it, I got the sense that these are vibrant communities with a vibrant culture. Take us inside the favelas.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is this mass impression that's been perpetuated. I think Rio's favelas are probably the most stigmatized urban communities in the world in terms of the reach of the stigma. People all over the world have heard of them and almost always in a very negative light. But the reality and why I started Catalytic Communities, which is the organization that hosts the news site Rio on Watch, is because these communities are actually incredibly inspiring once you start spending time in them. The struggle of Vila Autódromo that you've just heard, that resistance, that's part of that's an aspect of these communities, the strong resistance. They actually came out of slavery. The first favela was settled within 10 years of abolition in the 1890s. And so many of these communities are decades, if not a century old. And so when they're translated to slum, which implies something kind of temporary, haphazard, precarious, where people want to get out, most favelas are not in those conditions anymore. Most people value living in their communities. They value their communities. But because they're so stigmatized, that's really the biggest barrier to their development, is the misunderstanding and the lack of recognition of their assets. And so when you do walk around in favelas, they vary dramatically. There are 1,000 of them across Rio.
Wow.
That's another thing. You know, there's 1,000 of them. So when people generalize, there's no way to generalize. And so you have some that are in central areas, some that are peripheral, some that feel very urban, like a city unto themselves with over 100,000 people and many, many businesses, others that feel quite rural, secluded, that are more dormitory communities. You have favelas are where almost all, if not all, local culture comes from or through. So anything you associated with Rio culture, whether it's samba music or carnival, whether it's the kind of informal, friendly nature of people, whether it's the funk music, carioca funk, or pasinho, which is the latest dance craze, all of those were either born in or maintained and strengthened in Rio's favelas. And, you know, these are working class neighborhoods nowadays where people, everything they've built was built by residents. So every brick, every tile, the houses have an incredible amount of embedded history. And yeah, there's still poverty. Yes, there is crime because unfortunately what does characterize all most favelas is government neglect. The government has neglected them for 100 years. And I think that also has its roots in slavery. The fact that freed slaves and descendants of slaves ended up in these communities meant that the elite didn't think they needed to be served, right? You're going to serve the servants. And that logic is still very much, I think, in the culture. These communities aren't served properly. And so as a result, they become easy targets for drug traffickers. They become, places where some homes are built precariously and can fall in a landslide. So unfortunately, that becomes the prevailing narrative, even though that's actually a minority. So no more than 1% of people in any given favela with drug trafficking are actually actively involved in the drug traffic.
Teresa, most
houses are sturdy.
Let me ask you, because, and Maureen references the fact that thousands of people living in some of these favelas have been evicted because of the Olympics. I remember hearing similar stories in Beijing. It seems like this often happens when there is a big global event or big global sporting event. Teresa, how many people, about a minute before our first break here, but how many people have been evicted or forced to move from their favela or their home?
At last official count, it was 77,000 people late last year. So I think it's closer to 80,000 by now. People have been removed from their homes in these communities. And that's part of the reason it's so important to understand what these communities' assets are, is because unfortunately, people have been relocated mostly to public housing far away in much more secluded parts of the city that are run by these kind of cop mafias called militias. And so people are often less safe and significantly less well off than they were in a favela.
Well, let's take a very short break. That's Teresa Williamson, City Planner, Executive Director of Catalytic Communities, a Rio de Janeiro-based nonprofit. They do support the favela communities. We've been talking about that. Editor of Rio on Watch, and again, a watchdog news site reporting on favela perspectives in the lead-up to the Olympic Games. Joining us from Rio de Janeiro by Skype, I should add. Also with us, Maureen Donaghy, and she's Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Rutgers University in Camden, and she has been researching a community in Rio, and we've been talking about the effect of some of these big events on the people that live there, including the people in Rio de Janeiro. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Teresa Williamson, who's down in Rio de Janeiro, and Maureen Donaghy, who is sitting across from me in our Philadelphia studio, talking about the non-sports part of the lead-up to the Olympics, taking a place, of course, opening ceremonies tomorrow night in Rio. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Maureen, let me go back to you, and I mentioned Beijing, but it was also true the Atlanta Olympics here. There was some redevelopment to make way for the Olympics.
Right. So in Atlanta, part of the problem was that there was public housing that was torn down right around the Olympic Stadium. And so people were displaced because of that. Since then, most of them have been rehoused or moved to, you know, with rental vouchers elsewhere. Or there's been a lot of controversy, though, about what happened to the people that were displaced there. In Atlanta, there was also the problem of homeless people, were given bus tickets to go elsewhere.
Where did they go? Where did they send them?
So I don't know. It's just, you know, people who had some claim that, you know, maybe a family member lived somewhere else or, you know, they wanted to go somewhere, were given bus tickets out of town. And so there's this, you know, idea that the Olympics, or, you know, sort of make cities try to look cleaner, right? They try to clean up the city of the problems. And so, like in Rio, we see that along the highway to the into the city from the airport, they've put up barriers so that you can't see the favelas. Much like in Beijing, they also got rid of, you know, moved out a lot of the homeless, and same in Atlanta. So there's this, and same in, so with the World Cup in South Africa, that was also a big problem, that they moved the townships or put up barriers, you know, on the road from the airport. So it's a really common phenomenon across cities.
Teresa, let me go back to you. And one of the things that we have learned, saying what is the impact going to be on the Olympic athletes if they're swimming in the waters off Rio de Janeiro, but it does raise questions about the water conditions for the people who live in Rio de Janeiro. And this was all supposed to be improved in time for the Olympics opening tomorrow. Obviously, it didn't happen, but it does raise questions about just the health factors for people living in that city.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we know that sanitation is a huge contributor to health conditions in Rio, and that, you know, most of the city has untreated sewage, if it has collection at all. One of the promises of the games was that this would change, right? This was one of the legacy promises that wasn't met. There are quite a few of them. And 80% of the bay, for example, was supposed to be clean. To do that, they would have had to be treating the sewage that was coming out of many neighborhoods throughout the region. But none of that really got done. We have chronic issues with corruption with our water utility, our sanitation utility. It's water and sanitation. And I think generally with these promises, the legacy promises, it's important to have kind of cultural perspective on this.
Sure.
You know, here in Brazil, we have a saying, it's é para inglês ver. It literally means it's for the English to see. And it comes back since the 1800s, when England was pressing many countries to abolish slavery. Brazil abolished it created a law saying it was abolished. And that law was actually just passed, quote, for the English to see. It was known popularly that it was not in effect and that it was just to be stated. And the idea of kind of that comes all the way into the present day, where we see politicians make promises to the population. We see, you know, the plan sent to the IOC saying, you know, making all these big promises that really they never had any intention of fulfilling.
Wow. I wonder, Maureen, and this is, you know, it's obviously too late for the Olympics and too late for the people living in Rio de Janeiro, but just the amount of press on the water conditions, the pollution, the fetid waters in Rio. I mean, the world now knows what it's like to live in that city.
Yeah, I mean, I think for anyone who's traveled to Rio, you know, not to go in the ocean, that you might, you know, encounter some unpleasant water. You know, not to drink the water. The locals also mostly don't drink the water unfiltered. And I don't see that changing anytime soon, given the fiscal crisis in the state. So in June, the state's governor declared a state of calamity. And so it's unlikely that they're going to, you know, really move quickly to change anything.
Well, and I wonder, too, to you, Teresa, just all the political upheaval in Brazil. We know that the president Rousseff has been sort of no longer, I guess, considered the president, although I guess there's some question about that is not as well. And who will be the person from Brazil representing that country in the opening ceremonies on Friday night?
It'll be the interim president, Michel Temer, who's in very, very low approval ratings in the single digits, was never elected, would never have been elected, associated with a lot of you know, kind of, in my opinion, backward policies. You know, they were, for example, as soon as he took office, they were pulling back on the first major program to provide affordable public housing in Brazilian history. Now they've actually backtracked on that because of popular pressure. But they were cutting all sorts of things. And, you know, he's going to be there representing the country, even though he doesn't represent the country.
Do you think you're saying he doesn't represent? Well, obviously there's some.
Well,
questions.
I mean, he doesn't represent the right. Public. Obviously, he's officially the president at the moment.
Is this hurting the city? Do you think, Maureen, having the Olympics there?
I guess it could depend on how the rest of the couple of weeks go now. But I think most of the press internationally has been very negative. So you see, you know, on the morning news shows, the news anchors sitting in front of the beaches in Copacabana and Ipanema. And, you know, you see the beautiful scenes, but they're mostly focusing on the problems that have really ensued for the city. So I think once they start focusing on the athletics and the sports going on, that maybe some of that will disappear. In the end, you know, I think people will probably forget about the Olympics as they move forward. Maybe they will just remember the pretty scenes on the beaches.
I think for locals, if I could just mention.
Sure, go ahead, Teresa.
I think that the international press coverage can be seen as a negative from the city's perspective because of all of the kind of literally the dirt it's dug up. But it's also positive because you really can trace a lot of what's going on all the way back to slavery and kind of colonial Brazil and the lack of awareness that, you know, that's brought, the lack of conversation that goes on, the lack of education in schools, and people just aren't quite aware of the history. And I think bringing the international spotlight has allowed for this domestic conversation to go on and for people locally to be much more aware of these issues that had been kind of conditioned. You know, people are born and raised with the sewage. People are born and raised with the crime. People are born and raised with this mistreatment of favelas and this conditioning around what favelas are. And to have that spotlight has actually, I think, ultimately in the long term, we'll see it as a very positive part of a change in the long term that needed to happen. You can kind of compare it to maybe apartheid South Africa, where a lot of the established interests just were, born and raised into a system that they thought that was perfectly fine. And it took the international community shining a huge spotlight on the country to say, that's not okay. These are different times. And it's not okay to treat people that way and to treat citizens that way. And of course, that creates a lot of initial consternation and anger on the part of many people in the society to have that spotlight. But eventually, it brings about the reflection and the changes that are necessary.
And that's Teresa Williamson joining us from Rio, Executive Director of Catalytic Communities, editor of Rio on Watch. Also with us, Maureen Donaghy, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Rutgers University across the river in Camden, New Jersey. And we are talking about Rio, the impact of the Olympics, the preparation for the Olympics on the people living in that very large city. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. All of that coming in here. One of the things that you said, Maureen, to me before we went on the air, which is based on your experience with people living in Brazil and living in Rio de Janeiro, is their resilience. And I got that from Teresa. She was describing some of what's been going on down there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people have been asking, are the Olympics really going to come off? My answer is always, well, everything always does. You know, it will not be perfect, but people are resilient. They will bounce back. They will go on. They'll have a good time. They will enjoy it. And then they'll focus on the problems later.
And they, of course, had the World Cup 2 years ago, right?
That's right. So the World Cup was in 2014, and some of the removals that Teresa mentioned are related to the World Cup as well, but mostly concentrated around the stadium.
Yeah. Let me get Milton from Wayne to join us on Radio Times. And Milton, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My comment is to sort of disagree with the statements I've heard before, which are focusing on sort of the ethics impact on the poor around Rio de Janeiro. Forbes last month said the economy will still contract 3.7%. Bloomberg published an article saying the hospitals to treat tourists are tremendously overcrowded. Forbes published an article that said the airport security lines have started to snake around the second floor of the airport. So my question is, why not? The economic effect seems so negative in general. I don't possibly see how the attention brought to the favelas can possibly outweigh the negative predicted economic consequences from sources like Bloomberg, Forbes, et cetera.
Thanks for calling in, Milton. Teresa, can you take that? Oh, we lost her. Okay, we're getting her back. That was probably that funny little sound that we heard. Okay, that's very good. Teresa, you're back with us?
Yes.
Okay, that's great. Milton, our caller, said, you know, looking at Forbes and some of these other publications here in the United States saying that there are, you know, serious problems in Rio. Is it fair to blame the Olympics for these problems, or are these problems more endemic?
Oh, they're definitely endemic, but the Olympics has... So the Olympics in any city, this is my understanding from talking to folks all over the world who have experienced the games now, it creates this pretext, this opportunity for whoever's in leadership to do more of what they want to do with less interference from the population, because it creates what academics call a state of exception, which is a period where, you know, you don't have to go through the same kind of public audiences, you don't have to debate things, you can, you know, there's less transparency, basically. And so when you put you bring the Olympics, and I'm sure the IOC is aware of this, and, sure. And I believe very much that there is some sort of, I can't imagine that they wouldn't have done something about this if they cared. So I think it must be the other way. And basically, when it comes to a city like Rio, you know, where we have these endemic problems around corruption, around mistreating certain communities, around misinvesting, around investing on things that are flashy and good marketing material over real need, then you're just going to get more of that. And unfortunately, now we're going to be in debt paying for it for a long time. And those public resources should have been going to, you know, the top three priorities in any favela in Rio when you go and you have public meetings are education, health, and sanitation. People know what the needs are. They want those things. Those are the investments people want to see. And unfortunately, those aren't the ones we've gotten. And that's only been exacerbated by the games.
Let me read an email from Judy. I'll put this to you, Maureen. She says, what is the responsibility of the IOC in rewarding the games to cities with these records, Beijing, Sochi, and others? Have you thought about that?
A little bit. So there has been, the community of Villa Autódromo and others, they have gone to the IOC and brought their claims. But I don't know that it's the responsibility of the IOC, because really it's the city government and the state and the federal government who are in charge of developing the infrastructure and city planning. And so it's really up to them to make sure that the games are fair for all residents. And so the IOC can publicize, they can ask governments to change their ways, but I don't know that they have, you know, ultimate effect. Mm-hmm. They have no impact, you know, at the end of the day.
Well, the IOC does require a legacy. And it, you know, it's when the city of Rio applied, it included that in the proposals, mm-hmm. but they don't hold the city to the legacy. Right. They only hold the city to the stadiums. And so it's very clear that the legacy is really more just so that to make the Olympics more palatable, even though we know now that city after city, it leaves a trail of kind of financial burden and often communities, you know, disenfranchised communities left worse off.
Just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye to two of you, the both of you, I should say. Teresa, back to you. And this is based on some of the reporting from Rio on Watch. Since 2009, and that's when Rio got the games, 2,500 people killed by the police in Rio itself. Did I agree?
Yeah,
that
again,
right?
This is a chronic problem, but it's being exacerbated. I mean, my daughter and her cousin have been counting police officers. It became a game for them the last 3 days, and they've counted 349 police officers they've seen just in wandering around the city during their holidays. You know, we've got this insane amount of police presence. They're spending double the amount of security that they spent in London. And a lot of that is directed towards favelas. So we've seen an increase in the number of murders in favelas. Just yesterday in Alemão, there was a major operation and people, you know, spent the day kind of on the floor hoping they wouldn't get hit by stray bullets.
Wow. And is this, I mean, from your perspective, is this police or maybe even military and police trying to make sure that there will be secure and safe Olympics, or is it something beyond that?
The thing is that the safety is only going to come when people have access to opportunity and a good education. You know, people don't commit crimes for fun. Very few people are psychotic in that way. The reason there's a high crime rate in Rio is because of these, you know, historic problems that need to be addressed. And but even in the short term, I honestly don't believe that having this kind of security presence increases security. I think it just increases the expectation of violence, which generates more anger and frustration and potentially more violence.
Maureen, what do you hope the Olympics Games mean for the people living in Rio?
I guess I would have hoped that they would mean, you know, that these legacy projects would have been built. but I think now, as Teresa said, too, I think the spotlight is important on Rio, because so many of the issues in Rio with inequality, racial inequality, class inequality, are endemic to cities around the world. And so I think it's important that we connect what's going on in Rio to elsewhere, and that now the world kind of knows, like, you know, we're not just talking about the beaches and the pretty scenery of Rio, but that there's a lot more to the culture and also to the challenges that exist there.
In fact, we have an email from a caller or a listener saying, you know, there's a lot that Philadelphia, Rio, perhaps since you work in Camden, have in common in terms of what we've been talking about. You're nodding your head, Maureen.
Right. So so I've been looking at some cities in the U.S. compared to cities in Brazil. And, you know, there, what motivated the comparison is really this problem of displacement and lack of affordable housing across cities. So as cities develop, as they grow economically, you know, we see increases in rents and in home prices, which tends to force people out. And so it's a common problem across cities. And so in Rio and other cities of Brazil, affordable housing is the favelas.
Well, we're going to leave it on that note. Maureen Donahue, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Teresa Williamson, thank you for joining us from Rio.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And do stay with us. We'll be talking with Tom Goldman from NPR, talking about the sporty part of the Olympics. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The Summer Olympics officially begin tomorrow in Rio with the opening ceremony, and Ron Goldman is there reporting for NPR. There have been controversies and troubling reports leading up to the Games, the fetid water in the bay where the swimmers and sailors will compete, and allegations about doping in Russian athletes. But don't forget what it's all about, the many athletes who have been training for years for their moment in the sun. Tom Goldman joins us from Rio. He's in the NPR booth, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Thanks for asking. No one asks. Well, we are almost at the starting line, and my colleagues and I in the NPR Bureau are exhausted, so we haven't paced ourselves. It seems like every Olympics we get busier and busier, earlier and earlier, but we are ready to go.
Absolutely. You just came from a press conference, I understand, about the opening ceremony. Anything you can tell us?
Hot off the press. Yeah, I mean, they're a little cagey. They can't divulge everything. That's kind of a tradition at the Olympics. But I will tell you some basics about the incredible opening ceremony that you and everyone else in the U.S. will see on tape delay. The show is basically broken down into three pillars, and these pillars are, one pillar is the garden, Brazil being the garden of the world. Then there's the Brazilian smile. There will apparently be lots of hugging and joy. And then Brazilian diversity. And one of the creative directors, a man named Fernando Morales, he had kind of a newsy take on things. He said, it's going to be an important message of tolerance because the whole world is going the other way. And he mentioned the problems in Brazil politically, economically, financially. He mentioned Brexit. He mentioned Donald Trump.
Wow.
He said the whole planet is under threat, he said. The human race is under threat, and we need to send a message of seeking similarities and not differences. So I didn't get hard numbers for you, but it's safe to say there will be thousands cavorting on the stage. As I said, lots of hugging, probably some pyrotechnics, and, you know, the usual.
Do you think the opening ceremony to the Olympics has become an Olympic sport in and of itself? I'm thinking about London and some of these other places. Sochi?
Well, it certainly attracts, you know, it's the most impressive show around and, you know, goes on for about 4 hours. And, you know, there's a lot to it. It's a performance. But interestingly, NBC, in defending its decision to tape delay, said it's not a sporting event, which is why we can tape delay it, you know, so we can kind of watch and see what we have to, you know, what kind of narrative we have to plug in and put commercials in, because really hard to put commercials in a live event.
Catch us up on the controversy over doping and Russian athletes. There's a kind of a back and forth, or perhaps a open disagreement between the IOC and WADA. Where do things stand today?
It's a mess. It really is. I mean, I've covered a bunch of these, and there has never been a situation with doping the way there is now, obviously with the Russians. And you have right up to the end, I mean, it's still happening today with federations, you know, going over doping records of every Russian athlete, deciding, you know, who's in and who's out. You've got the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which set up an office here in Rio, which is dealing with appeals by Russians who already have been banned. They're handing down decisions today. And we're still not sure when this thing is going to end. I mean, the opening ceremony is tomorrow, so we're assuming something has to be resolved by then, and the Russians have to have a final team roster. But then, yeah, as you say, on top of this, you have the IOC and the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, sniping at each other. IOC is, blaming WADA for dragging its feet because it had allegedly had information about the widespread state-sponsored Russian doping years ago, about all the way back to 2010. WADA is defending itself. Interestingly, there's a new report out of ProPublica by reporter David Epstein, who talked to the man who was the chief investigator for WADA, who really kind of comes down on the IOC's side in this debate. He says WADA really did have information that it dragged its feet on, that the only way that WADA would move was if this investigator leaked information to the media, and then the media splashed stories all over, like the New York Times did and 60 Minutes did in May, and that prompted WADA to move. So it's really, really, really a mess, and the really depressing thing is these two entities are supposed to be kind of working together to kind of control this thing. I think a lot of people are saying when this all shakes out, you know, if we get through the games, you know, without any more major doping crisis, you got to look at this whole system of how we try to control doping and ask some really tough questions and maybe some new questions, like maybe this is foolhardy to pursue this whole catch and punish kind of thing. Some people are saying you even have to maybe legalize the stuff and medically monitor it. So hopefully that will happen and it won't just be the status quo.
And we will do a show about that because that sounds really intriguing. And I do want to talk about some of the athletes and some of the events that certainly you will be looking for. But are there – yeah, remember that?
Sports, right.
Sports, yeah. Exactly. But let me just ask you first about the fetid waters and, of course, the Zika that was all over the news and certainly the doping. I mean, there's always these dramas before an Olympics. But do you think this is overshadowing these Olympics?
Well, it is, but I'll tell you, from the ground, and this is a very, very small sample size, but, you know, my colleagues and I, we have counted maybe 10 mosquitoes we've seen and swatted. And, you know, we've gotten whiffs of the lagoon where the main press center is near when the wind is right, and it's pretty bad. You know, you are hearing things about, I think the latest report said 3 teaspoons of the water from, you know, where these athletes will be competing, you know, the triathletes, the open water swimmers, could make you very, very, very sick. So the party line still by the athletes point seems to be we're here to compete. We deal with difficult situations everywhere. Yeah, this is worse, but we're just going to, deal with it.
So what are some of the athletes or some of the events that you are particularly interested in?
Well, I'm intrigued by rugby. I had a story this morning on rugby.
Yes, you did.
I didn't just say that to pitch the story, but it sounds like a lot of fun. And what fascinates me is these games are 16 minutes long. And, so a lot of American sports fans complain that their games are too long. Well, here you go. Here's rugby. It's rugby sevens, which is a different kind of rugby with only seven players. And they have seven-minute halves and then a two-minute halftime and then another seven-minute half. But it looks like a really fun game. And for female athletes, it's the green light to go ahead and hit each other, which is really cool, and tackle each other. So very physical game. And I think Americans will, could take to it as long as they, if they have the patience to stay glued to their TV for 16 minutes. I don't think that should be too tough.
No, I don't think so.
So there's rugby, men's and women's. It's in the games for the first time in 92 years. A couple of athletes looking forward to Usain Bolt. I mean, obviously he's the most famous athlete here, the great sprinter who really has redefined sprinting. On a personal level, I watched what he did in Beijing when he first exploded on the scene and broke world records, and then watched him again in London in 2012, and would just love to see him here finish it off with three more golds in the 100, 200, and the 4x100 meter relay. It's interesting because he says this is his last Olympics, and he, like Michael Phelps, for instance, you kind of have a sense, well, he's on the downside of his career, seems to be. He's not going to pull another Beijing where he won 8 individual gold medals. But Bolt seems to be at full strength, and so he very well could win these races. So that should be exciting. And let me mention just one more.
Sure.
People may remember her from 4 years ago, Clarissa Shields, this great female boxer from the U.S., this wonderful young woman who, again, using that phrase, exploded on the scene in 2012, won a gold medal the first time women's boxing was in the Olympics. And then, sadly, just kind of dropped off the radar. And the sad part of it was, and she told journalist Sue J. Johnson about this, Sue J. Johnson has been following Clarissa for several years now. She told her that people were telling her, well, her image is too hard. She's got to soften it a little bit. And Clarissa's response to that was, I box. I beat the crap out of people. This is what I do. And so what I'm really hoping is she goes out and she wins another gold medal, destroys the field, and some sponsors are brave enough to look at this young woman and say she's young, she's smart, she's talented, she's outspoken. Let's put her on a Wheaties box because she's as much a great champion as any of the Olympians who win gold medals.
Hear, hear. And let's talk about the women's soccer team. They won yesterday.
Yahoo! they did in front of not many people.
Yeah. And I didn't realize there were going to be games, I guess, before the opening ceremony.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they got to start these matches in the group stages. There are a lot of soccer matches to go through. It'll be fun to see how they do, and it'll be really fun if the Brazilian women continue to do well. They won their opening match yesterday with the great Marta and a number of other great athletes. And if Brazil faces off against the U.S., that will be a fantastic championship game. Every Olympics, the host country has its special sports. Canada had curling, Beijing. I can't remember what it was there, but it was a lot of diving, perhaps, a lot of things that are specific to that country. Well, obviously, soccer is big here. After the devastating World Cup by the men in 2014, they're looking for a rebound. And so it'll be really neat to see if Brazilians get behind their soccer teams. I'm sure they will.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, Tom. Ron. Ron Goldman.
No, it's Tom. You got it. Ron's that other guy.
Yeah, Ron is that other guy. Yes, exactly. sorry about that. You mentioned the fact that you're so tired. So what do you do downtime when you're in Rio?
I'm turning my colleague and saying, she's asking me what we do in our downtime. He's laughing.
He's rolling
his
eyes.
He's laughing right now.
Right.
We don't have downtime.
No.
It's not allowed at the Olympics. We just eat, breathe, sleep Olympics, and we're getting ready to do it. It's only 17 days. We can survive.
Well, we feel your pain.
It's a good pain.
It is a good pain. Tom Goldman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, Marty, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. And we do check in with Tom Goldman from time to time, reporting on sporting events around the world. And he joined us this morning from the NPR studios in Rio de Janeiro. He will be reporting on the Olympics that start officially on Friday night. Well, Kelsey Worrell swam a personal best at the Olympic trials, taking first in the 100-meter butterfly, beating defending Olympic champ Dana Vollmer. Worrell is the 2016 NCAA champion in the event, and she's a South Jersey native. Radio Times' Mary Cummings Jordan has known Worrell for many years, and they caught up last month as a 22-year-old was preparing for the biggest race of her life.
Typically, we wake up in the fall. Practices start at 6 a.m. In the spring, we get to sleep in till 7. And mornings are about an hour and a half long. Then we can go to the weight room for 45 minutes to an hour and lift. We have a couple hours off, and then we're back at 2:30 for another 2 hours. And in between is school in the spring and fall. And thankfully, I haven't had to worry about that the past couple months. But otherwise, it's recovering as best as we can, hopefully getting in a nap or going to see the athletic trainer for treatment on one of our body parts that's probably hurting.
So you're at the University of Louisville. I mean, as far mm-hmm. as college life is concerned, do you have to be pretty regimented when it comes to your training? Avoid college food?
Yes. Freshman year, I ate a little bit too much college food, I think. But now I live off campus, and I can be a little bit more strict with what I'm eating. But you have to be use your time extremely well. And I'm pretty type A, so that's not too hard for me. But sometimes it can seem like swimming is all we're doing, and that's when it gets a little hard. Mm-hmm.
Rio, of course, has been the focus of a lot of debate because of the Zika virus. How have you mm-hmm. decided to deal with this?
I'm not worried at all. I have some teammates from Louisville who have visited the country just this past year and didn't really even see mosquitoes while they were there. I know Team USA is completely prepared to keep their athletes safe. I have already received mosquito netting for inside the village mm-hmm. to go above my bed while I sleep, and they have given me bug spray and other chemicals to soak my clothes in to repel the mosquitoes. So I'm not concerned. I'm just concerned about swimming fast.
All right. And one more question for you. So what was going through your mind at the end of the 100 fly trials when you realized you'd punched that ticket to Rio?
It was extremely emotional. I hit the wall, and before I saw my name on the board, I heard the announcer say my name, and I just immediately started crying, and I got to hug Dana Vollmer, and she just whispered, like, "You are an Olympian," and that meant so much to me, and it's just been a whirlwind since. I got to see my family right away. I'm sponsored by a swim company called Tier, and they got to hook them up with some front row seats, so I got to see them and embrace them right away, and it's just been an absolute dream.
All right. Well, listen, Kelsey, just want to let you know you've got a lot of people rooting for you in the neighborhood.
Thank you so much. That means the world to me.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
And that's Mary Cummings Jordan speaking with Olympic swimmer Kelsey Worrell. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Nick Kowalski on phones this week. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.